a vibration from a note can affect different parts of your body and emotions. To me, that is the recipe for a medicinal moment.
Hi, Brene. Thanks for joining me today.
Hello.
Taking the time.
Yes.
Where are you coming from?
Happy to be here.
We're happy to have you. And you're coming from, where are you at, in Baltimore?
I'm actually in New York right now.
Oh, you're in New York right now.
Yes, okay. But I am based in Baltimore.
Okay. So are you in New York for work?
Yes, I am here working.
So I'm super excited because you'll be joining the ranch this August for our second annual jazz week. And you'll be performing, singing, and we're super excited to have you. So I read that you got your start as a tap dancer at age 3.
Yes, this is very true. It started at home. at home. My father is a tap dancer and a vocalist and theater person and visual artist. So I tell people I grew up in a artistic spaceship.
Wow, that's awesome. So do you still tap?
Oh, yes, that's for sure. This is why I'm here. And I will be doing some tap dancing while I'm there.
That's so awesome.
Yeah.
I love tap dancing. I remember I watched, is it Gregory Hines who was on, wasn't he on Will and Grace?
Yes.
He was great. I've always loved him a lot.
Yeah.
At what point did you realize that this was going to be your life?
I think I realized it very early. I would say probably turning 5 or 6. Wow. Again, watching my father perform Broadway, off-Broadway shows. My first awakening of that moment actually started here in New York City. I was celebrating, I think, my 5th birthday. And he was doing a show off-Broadway called Staggerly. And at the end of the show, they were throwing like these Mardi Gras beads out into the audience. Uh-huh. And I just remember just being like, I have to do this one day. And it just became a part of the process of learning, you know, in my household. And then also my father being a co-partner to a dance school called Creative Expression Dance Studio. Mm-hmm. So it was literally my everyday livelihood of dance and music and theater. And I was just all in. I admire my father so much. I just wanted to do everything that he did.
I read somewhere that that you said a college political science class actually solidified your path as an artist, which is something I wouldn't think. Probably most people wouldn't think. How did that happen? Speak a little bit about that.
Yeah. So I was taking a political science class and we were learning a lot about just crime and just the different social disparities amongst classes. Mm-hmm. And I felt called to use this information and to fuse it into a creative means to bring about awareness. So really like grounding myself around just societal issues and being able to use art to ignite change became the catalyst for me. And also growing up in Flint, Michigan, and again, my father not only just being a tap dancer, but also an educator and being involved in the community. I think that was like my big aha moment. I wanted to then be able to use my platform and my art to speak on some of these different issues and challenges that we face here.
During the jazz week last year, because I haven't been exposed to a lot of jazz music with my upbringing, but it seemed like it was all had something very deep to say. It wasn't just a performance. I mean, there was a lot of content about social justice and those kind of things, which I think is, you know, I think I always say that I think music and art are windows to the soul, and to find it's a way to get in and talk to people.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Do you think that music is medicine?
Yes.
What does the rhythm do that gets in there?
Well, our heart is a rhythm. You know, our heart beats in a rhythm. And so, you know, when you have emotions, it is a molecular experience. Like you feel things, you know, like physically can feel things. So a vibration from a note can affect different parts of your body and emotions. To me, that is the recipe for a medicinal moment if you're open to that. Right. It can also trigger, you know, negative things as well. But for me, the sound, the vibrations of the sound and where it resonates in your body is the part where you begin to feel the healing.
I agree. And I think that's kind of substantiated. Now there's all these sound healing classes where they play the crystal balls because the vibration gets into you. So I think there's a lot of research now focused around sound and music and how it can heal a person. There's also a lot of, like, I interviewed someone recently who does non-talk therapy, where she says we hold trauma in your physical bodies. So something physical can sometimes interrupt that or help with the healing. So, and I think, you know, vibration is that way too, for sure.
Yeah.
I noticed that you started a foundation with your husband?
We have a band, collective.
Okay, a collective.
The Baltimore Jazz Collective.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So we are a conglomerate of musicians who are each band leaders in their own right, but we come together and we compose original music. We also pay tribute to composers from Baltimore and reimagine their music and then educate in that way as well.
Right. And so I read when I've gone to jazz concerts, it looks like that everyone is just kind of ad-libbing off of each other. There's no like one leader. It's collaboration.
No,
it's a democratic form of music.
It is. It definitely is. I mean, there is a form. There is a structure that's there that also allows for each person to have a say in the conversation. And the band or the musicians are supporting each soloist, you know, as you pass it around with the side of the form. I mean, that essentially is how jazz functions in any situation.
Right. Now, you have an album out, correct?
We do. We have a record out. Yes, called the Baltimore Jazz Collective.
Do you have your own music style, or would you say that who are your influences? And I don't think your music, is there a genre or not really?
Yeah, well, so for me, I had a EP that I released called the Destination Forever. It is many genres, very soulful. I struggle with labels because there's such influence. But that particular project, I would say, is a cross between, you know, soul, R&B, just like those two in particular. And then there's like some a cappella music that's also in there, where I use the voice with some percussion. So it also has like a world music approach to it as well. So it's a mix up of different genres for that project.
Yeah, so if I was going to go on an app and try to find your music, what would I type in?
Well, you could go to SoundCloud to get access to Destination Forever EP, and I guess you would type in soul, R&B, you know.
Okay, it would. I suppose I could.
And you could just put my name. Yeah,
I was going to say that would be that's too easy. No, I think I also read that you are involved in spoken word,
Yes,
do you perform spoken word?
Well, I like to infuse it within my work. I love to use it as a tool for storytelling.
Yeah, it is a great tool for storytelling.
Yeah, I would never say that I'm just a straight up poet or a spoken word artist, and that's the only thing that I do. I do use it as a means of communication.
What is the Baby Lawrence Legacy Project?
Yes, the Baby Lawrence Legacy Project is an archival performative process It is an evening length show, but it is also, I'm also building curriculum tied to it. It's about a tap dancer named Baby Lawrence, who's originally from Baltimore, who in the, he lived between the span of 1921 to 1974. He was the first tap dancer to have a jazz album as a band leader in the mid-1950s. And, you know, he had a huge impact on the jazz community. I would say he really was a part of the innovation of the sound that we know today called bebop. He was right there with Charlie Parker in that era of Dizzy Gillespie, really, really presenting tap dance as a part of the music. And not just so much as the dance. I mean, the dance was there for sure, but he was clearly a musician in the way how he presented and represented tap dance as a part of the musical expression.
So the Legacy Project is you oversee that project.
Yeah,
right?
So I've gathered a lot of archival information and research. I've been unpacking a lot of the information and creating compositions and choreography. And then there's also the use of actual archives in the process of how we interact with it. And that's something very niche to tap dance. Tap dancers are very much obsessed with history and being able to look to footage and sit around the table and find sources of inspiration and then try to reimagine and relive that. So in this process, which is why I call it an archival performative process, because I am blending jazz music with choreography and hip hop. There's a turntablist as well who is a part of this process. And then I'm also working with another tap dancer who has figured out a way how to use Ableton Evo Suite program where I can then trigger with my foot on the floor and different samples of like audio and visual. So I hit the floor and there's like a visual that'll pop up on the screen. So it is very, very much of today and futuristic and per se, but also being able to go from the past to the present to the future. So I'm kind of exploring all of those avenues in this work.
So the Legacy Project, is it to raise awareness of his work and how important he was?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many, there's only one documentary that was done on him in the 80s. Well, it was released in the 80s. It's like a 30-minute documentary that was called The Jazz Hoofer. And then there's the album, and then there's like maybe a couple of clips that exist on YouTube. But all of the great hoofers and tap dancers who we love and had the privilege to touch, you know, knew him, he died way too soon. So our generation, we're all like inspired by someone. So he's kind of like an urban legend, you know? And so it's like my way of being able to unpack and also maybe dig a little bit deeper into him as a human as well, because I've been able to kind of uncover and discover some of the personal challenges that he went through around drug addiction and being incarcerated, you know, pretty often throughout his life.
Do you go and perform under this project and people come? Okay. That's awesome.
Yeah. So we did a tour. We did a tour all last year. We moved it around. We performed at the Apollo Theater. We performed it at the Ringling Museum in Florida. And definitely it kicked off in Baltimore. We're now getting, I'm actually preparing to do an iteration of a sneak peek this coming Monday at the Guggenheim here in New York City.
Wow. You are so busy.
I am. And then we're taking it to the Berkshires. Then we're going out to the Berkshires in August before I come to you.
Wow. You're going to be very busy. That's great.
Yes. Yeah.
I hope you're enjoying today's podcast as much as I am. To learn more about our wonderful presenters and exciting weeks coming up at the ranch, go to rancholaporta.com and check out our events calendar. Make sure to mention the podcast when making your reservation to take advantage of a special offer. Some restrictions may apply. I feel like you don't hear as much about tap as a lot of other dance forms. Why do you think that is?
There's a lot of theories that I have. Mm-hmm. You know, I think culturally, just the art form itself kind of it didn't go away. It went more underground and it kind of started to survive in dance studios and not even as much in the jazz community as it used to be. So for me, I'm like, I hear about it all the time.
Right. Yeah. No, for sure.
But it just wasn't the popular dance form. Like things change over time. So dance styles change. And I wouldn't even say that, okay, now we had rock and roll and hip hop that came along. But tap dancers were still dancing to the music and doing innovative things. It just wasn't as popular. And then there's also, you know, a lot of arguments around who invented the dance. You know, with tap dancing being rooted in a deep American culture through the bodies of Black people, there's a level of erasure that has, you know, taken place to where you just kind of forget it. And you move on and you do it a whole nother way. And then that becomes the precedence of what tap dance is. You know, a lot of times people only associate tap dance with Broadway in a certain format. And it lived there, but it also, you know, it lives in other spaces as well.
Well, maybe you're the person to bring it back. Kind of like what Madonna did with the underground dance scene in New York, like with Vogue, right? I mean, it's still going on. People just aren't shining a light on it sometimes.
Yeah. We're in that process of doing something very big that I can't say now because I had to sign an NDA. Right. But hopefully that will shift.
That's awesome. Yes. Awesome. So let's talk about something else. What is the Harlem for Flint project that you did?
The Harlem for Flint project at the time was a fundraiser that I gathered a lot of folks in the Broadway community and jazz musicians to raise some money for the water crisis that was happening in Flint, Michigan at the time. So we partnered with National Black Theater and Harlem Stage, Revive Music Group, and a few others came together, and we raised about $10,000 that night to go to the I think the Greater Flint Community Arts Foundation, and you know, to use that money to go towards any arts organization that's using the arts as a tool for healing and families who want to use art to, you know, inspire them to work through that challenging time.
Right. So another thing that you do is you and your husband both lecture at the John Hopkins Peabody Institute. Mm-hmm. So what are some messages that you like to share with your students there? What are some of the things that are really important for them to hear?
So I came in there teaching tap, and it was important for me to give them a sense of belonging, because a lot of them are very skilled ballet dancers, contemporary dancers, but not much tap dance training. So I tried to get them to understand that this is like a dance that belongs to us as American people, and get involved in that way, even at the very basic level. And I also was teaching the music for dance class, so helping them to be able to articulate and communicate with musicians as dancer is just a skill set that you have to learn. And so it's a language, being able to understand that there's various languages in art. And so I just try to bring to them a different approach to language and expression through music and dance.
Right. That's awesome. So you talk about creating pathways for the next generation to live sustainable lives while being excellent in their craft. What does a sustainable creative life look like in 2026? Because it's kind of funny, because I remember when I was in high school, I mean, in college, I was taking lots of dance classes because I love dance. And I remember the teacher, probably because I wasn't that good, they're like, she's like, yeah, well, make sure you get a real degree, too.
Oh, my gosh. That's terrible.
Yeah, so, yeah.
For me, a sustainable way of living, I'm still working on that.
Well, you hustle. It sounds like you hustle a lot. You got a lot of things going on.
Yeah, I do. I work on various projects, but I'm also, I think there's a balancing act. You know, you have to be able to balance work and like what's working for your body, what serves you. And if you're able to navigate what serves you, what can elevate you and to allow you to evolve, then that's the way you need to go. And for me, the way it looks like for me is, and I love community. I thrive off of bringing communities together. I thrive off of collaboration. And I think that is the pathway of like sustainability is connection, collaboration. Yeah. Like nobody does anything by themselves. And so I think that as an artist, even if your practice and your discipline is just music, to sustain yourself, you might want to immerse yourself and connect with dancers. You might want to connect with theater people. Mm, you may want to see how can you collaborate so that you can build something that can last. You know what I'm saying? And be able to have multiple streams of income.
I think that community is something that we really need. I feel like we've slipped away from it a little bit, but I think that, you know, all kinds of communities need to build. And diversity in the communities too.
That is something that I can honestly say, you know, from some of my work in grassroots building, like when I lived in Philadelphia, I was working with an artist and someone who was an art enthusiast, but he was a business person. And we created this thing called Fourth Wall Art Salon, where we were doing these art salons in Philadelphia with the intention of creating a diverse environment. And we were able to bring together a certain population of people who just were not patronizing like the Philadelphia Museum of Art. We were able to capture a certain demographic of people that all these dinosaur institutions were paying us to come in to bring programming in there because they saw how wide the variety of people were showing up. And the experience had such a huge impact.
So, Brené, in our conversation today, it occurred to me that if you were on American Idol or America's Got Talent, they would call you a triple threat. Because you can sing, dance, and act, probably, right?
Yes.
So I'm curious, who are some of the mentors in your life or people that you looked up to?
So I would say Mabel Lee was someone who I actually had the privilege of working with. She was considered queen of the Soundies. She did hundreds of Soundies films. She was a tap dancer. She was a singer. She was a chanteuse. Like she had a lot of skill set. And I got to spend like the last maybe 25 years of her life with her. Closely as a mentor. I even lived with her for a little while when I was coming back and forth to New York from Philly and just taking on jobs. I was probably one of the only people that she let live with her. Mm-hmm. And then I drew a lot of inspiration from someone like, you know, Sammy Davis Jr., Gregory Hines. There were also people, I really admired different people for different reasons, you know? Mm-hmm. So some of them had multiple talents. Some of them only had certain gifts. Like, I love Stevie Wonder and his music and his writing. For me, it kind of gave me permission to write however I felt I needed to. Someone like Lauryn Hill was another one who I found a lot of inspiration because she's a very talented actor, songwriter, you know. She raps. She's very gifted, just writer and all the things. Those are some of the people who I grew up really admiring and, you know, pulling inspiration from.
So do you write your own songs, your own music?
I do write most of my songs, yes. And I also collaborate with other musicians. But a lot of time, my writing process will start with tap dance. And, you know, I'll, like, record myself. And then I'll, like, hear a repetition of a rhythm that'll then inspire some type of melodic structure. And then next thing, there's, like, a feeling and an emotion, and I'm writing, you know.
Yeah.
So and then sometimes it's the other way around, you know. But that is somewhat of my process.
Is it sometimes what's going on in your own personal world and the things you're thinking about and what's happening?
Yeah. Yes.
So now your life, you perform a lot, you travel a lot. I mean, dancing doesn't seem like it would be relaxing per se. I mean, our current wellness definition is, you know, is like relaxing, chilling out. And, you know, so our nervous systems on this planet are just pushed. So do you find that the dancing and the performing is actually calming for you?
Yes, it is. I need to move sometimes to, like, cleanse the palate in my brain.
Exactly.
You know, put some music on and just move my body. You know, we were talking earlier about how the body pretty much keep score, you know.
It does keep score
of a lot of things. And so it's such a mechanism for release for me. Mm. When I don't move for days, I actually, like, tighten up and feel, like, pain in certain areas of my body.
What is it? Tell me a couple of things you do to take care of Brené.
I like to use my bathroom as a hydrotherapy space.
That's great.
So my tub is, like, my sacred place where I love to soak and just put some music on or light a candle. I do practice yoga, you know, just I have to center myself. I've been listening to, like, words of wisdom from a Shaolin monk, Shingi. I listen to a lot of his content. And that has been, like, very transformative for me over the last 6 months. I just try to feed my soul with things that are going to center me and, you know, help me move through the day, because I am not only responsible for myself. I have children. I work with people of different ages, you know, and so there's just, I have to make space to take care of Brené.
Right. So do you ever take a day off? And let's say you were off on a Sunday, what's your perfect Sunday in Baltimore?
A perfect Sunday would, you know, be relaxing, snuggling with my kids, you know, watching a film. It's very difficult for me to do nothing because I'm always busy.
Yeah,
but
if I had
a chance to do nothing, I would just sit, maybe read, you know. That's something that I feel very guilty about, that I don't read as much anymore.
Yeah, me
so,
too.
Yeah, I would love to just, like, read. And I think one day I did take time out and did nothing, and I had some friends over and we just had conversation and fellowship. You know, I love the fellowship.
Right. So my last question about Baltimore, are the crab cakes really as good as everyone says they are?
They are.
I would come there for that. Well, let me, I want to maybe, can we just give our audience a little taste of what it'll be like when you're here in August? Maybe you could sing just a 2 or 3 lines or something for us.
Okay. Okay. Let's see. The moon is the same up above you, aglow with its cool evening light. but shining at night in Tunisia never does it shine so bright. The stars are aglow in the heavens, but only the wise understand that shining at night in Tunisia, they guide you through the desert sand.
Oh, beautiful. I can't wait for you to come here. And I'm, you know, you have, your aura just glows. So it's awesome.
Thank you.
It's awesome. Even just
I'm so
virtually.
Excited about coming.
Yeah.
I'm
so
really
thank
excited.
You. And thank you for spending this time with me today. And I will look forward to seeing you in August at Jazz Week.
Yay.
What strikes me after speaking to Brené today is that she really does embody something the ranch is always talking about. That is that wellness isn't a single practice, it's an integration. For her, art and healing aren't two different things. Her tap floor, that's wellness. Her jazz lyric, that's a wellness practice. Community, that's a wellness practice. They're all the same conversation, but as Brené says, they're just spoken in different rhythms. A few things that will stay with me. The first is the idea that Brené was tap dancing in Flint, Michigan at the age of 3, before she even had words for what she was doing. There's something kind of profound about that. So much of our adult life is spent trying to find our way back to what our body has always known. Brené never lost that thread. She's been listening her whole life. A second thing I'm taking away today is her work with the Baby Lawrence Legacy Project and her commitment to honoring people who came before her. In a culture that's obsessed with what's next, it's beautiful to hear someone talk about lineage, about being a steward for someone else's gift, not just creating your own. And finally, not only does she talk about joy, she exudes joy. She says joy isn't a luxury. It isn't a reward you get after a lot of hard work. It is the work. And for her, her music and her performing is medicine. And I believe it. It's medicine for the soul. She just exudes joy and positivity. And that's the message I think each of us could use right now. I hope I'll see you August 22nd when we welcome Brené and other jazz artists for Jazz Week here at Rancho La Puerta. Until I see you next time, I'm wishing you health and daily joy.